Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Dorothy Gundy. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, South Korea is creating traps and using unmanned aircraft and expert gunmen in an effort to stop wild pigs from spreading the disease swine flu from North Korea. African swine flu is deadly to pigs, but is not a threat to humans. The virus has killed large numbers of pigs in many Asian countries. Experts believe wild hogs are a main reason for its spread. Officials say North Korea has ignored the South's repeated calls for joint efforts to stop the disease. South Korea has destroyed about 154,500 pigs in the past month. All were taken from farms near the North Korean border. North Korea has not released any detailed reports on the disease. But South Korea's intelligence agency says that pig herds in one North Korea province were almost totally lost. North Korea observers in Seoul say pork prices in markets there have increased. North Korea first reported an outbreak in May after the disease spread widely in neighboring China. Chinese officials say farms in the country have slaughtered at least 1.17 million pigs in an effort to control the disease since August 2018. North Korea told the World Organization for Animal Health that 77 of 99 pigs at a farm in Jagong Province died of the disease. The remaining 22 pigs were destroyed. North Korea said it is fighting hard to stop the disease's spread, but has not reported any other outbreaks. Sehun is director of South Korea's National Intelligence Service. He told lawmakers in a private meeting last month that African swine flu has spread across North Korea. He reportedly added that groups of wild pigs in an area north of the capital, Pyongyang, had been annihilated and people were complaining about the lack of meat. South Korean officials confirmed the first swine flu outbreak in the town of Paju on September 17th. Since then, officials have reported at least 13 more cases. Failure to contain the disease would be severely damaging for South Korea's pork industry. The situation would be much worse for the North, where food supplies are often limited. South Korean officials say North Korea had about 2.6 million pigs in 14 government-run or cooperative farms before the disease's outbreak. Cho Chung-wi is a former North Korean official in charge of farm animal issues. He fled to South Korea in 2011. He says pork makes up as much as 80% of protein eaten by North Korea's 25 million people. Many North Koreans raise and sell a pig or two each year to be able to buy rice. Cho said, A 100-kilogram hog can be sold to buy about 150 kilograms of rice. That is enough for a family for a year. He said North Korean animal health officials and farms do not kill animals even if they are sick. African swine fever spreads easily through contact with infected animals, animal waste, and contaminated substances such as food, clothing, and vehicles. The 248-kilometer border between North and South Korea is the most heavily secured in the world. However, South Korean officials and experts say wild pigs could still enter in and out of North Korea by swimming across rivers. Cho said heavy rains from a powerful ocean storm in September likely caused contaminated soil and water from North Korea to enter the South. Insects and rats could also spread the virus, he said. Whatever the source of the South Korean outbreaks, experts say controlling movements of wild pigs is very important.
Since ancient times, owls have been called many things, such as mysterious. These birds can be found in many parts of the world. And today, one kind of owl is causing a problem in forests of the northwestern United States. Barred owls are a large species native to eastern North America. But they began moving west at the start of the 20th century. By 1973, large numbers of barred owls had arrived in the western state of Washington. Later, they moved south into Oregon and California. In parts of the Pacific Northwest, the owls are now believed to be causing a drop in the population of a smaller, less aggressive bird, the northern spotted owl. In many ways, the barred owl is the spotted owl's worst enemy. The barred owl has more babies per year and eats the same animals like squirrels and wood rats. And their numbers are now larger in many parts of the spotted owl's traditional territory.
David Weens is a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, a federal agency that studies the Earth and its natural resources. He and other officials are doing something unusual to protect spotted owls, killing barred owls. It is a controversial experimental program. More than 2,400 barred owls have already been shot. Weens is the son of a well-known bird expert and grew up with a fascination for birds. He has mixed feelings about the program. "It's a little distasteful, I think, to go out killing owls to save another owl species," he says. But he adds, "We knew that barred owls were outcompeting spotted owls, and their numbers were growing too fast." To catch barred owls, officials put digital bird collars on the ground. Then they step back and wait as several sounds from the devices fill the air. All of this happens in the dark of night. Barred owls dislike other birds in their territory, so they will fly down and chase other owls out. That is when Weens and his team try to shoot them.
The federal government has been trying for years to save the northern spotted owl. Some years ago, this bird was at the center of a huge battle over logging rights across Washington, Oregon, and California. In 1990, the northern spotted owl was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act and appeared on the cover of Time magazine. Then officials suspended logging on millions of hectares of forests to protect the bird. But the spotted owl population continued to fall. During that time, researchers began to study another threat. Larger, more aggressive barred owls were competing with spotted owls for food and space and pushing them out of some areas. Now comes this final effort to see whether the government can save spotted owls.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service launched the experiment a few years ago. It has raised questions such as, how much is it possible to reverse a drop in population that has been happening for years, caused in part by human activity? And as climate change continues to push species out and affect how and where plants and animals live, how much should people get involved? Just as with other conservation measures that involve killing one animal to save another, the program has also led to legal questions and debate. Still, the Fish and Wildlife Service has a permit to kill up to 3,600 owls, and if the program works, could decide to expand its efforts.
In four small study areas in Washington, Oregon, and California, Weens and his team have been killing barred owls to see whether the native birds return to their land once their competitors are gone. Small efforts to remove barred owls in Northern California and Canada's British Columbia have shown promising results. Weens now sees his gun as a research tool. He said that by getting involved, humans may be able to achieve more biodiversity in the environment, rather than just having barred owls take over and wipe out all the prey species. But not everyone agrees. Mark Beckoff is a professor of ecology and biology at the University of Colorado, Boulder. He strongly opposes the experiment and says humans should find another way to help owls. Beckoff notes that there is no way to see it as a good thing if you're killing one species to save another.
Michael Harris directs the Wildlife Law Program for Friends of Animals, a nonprofit group. He thinks the government should direct its attention on what humans are doing to the environment and protect habitats rather than blaming barred owls. Some Americans see a responsibility to get involved. They note that humans are to blame for activities like logging, which helped lead to the drop in spotted owl numbers. But other people just see a losing situation. A decision not to kill the barred owl is a decision to let the spotted owl go extinct, said Bob Salinger. He is conservation director with the nonprofit Audubon Society in Portland, Oregon. If reducing the barred owl population improves the number of spotted owls, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife may consider killing more barred owls as part of a longer-term effort. Enough success has been noted that the experiment already has been extended to August of 2021. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In November of 1840, the American people elected William Henry Harrison as their ninth president. Harrison was a retired general and a well-known Indian fighter. Many people considered him a hero for his victory over Native Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Americans elected John Tyler as Harrison's vice president. The two men ran on the campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler Too. Harrison was the first president from the Whig Party. Some Whig leaders, including Senators Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, believed they could control the newly elected president. Harrison asked Daniel Webster to edit the speech he planned to give after the swearing-in ceremonies. Webster removed some material from the inaugural speech and suggested other changes. The inauguration took place on March 4, 1841. It was the coldest inaugural day in the nation's history. Harrison spoke on the front steps of the Capitol building. He gave the longest inaugural address of any president. It lasted almost 2 hours. But Harrison did not wear a winter overcoat or hat. He got sick, probably from standing so long outside in the cold. Rest was his best treatment. But the new president was so busy, he had little time to rest. Harrison's health grew worse. Late in March 1841, he developed pneumonia. Doctors did everything they could to cure him, but nothing seemed to help. On April 4th, exactly 1 month after he became president, William Henry Harrison died. Vice President John Tyler was then at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Daniel Webster, the new Secretary of State, sent his son on horseback to tell Tyler of the president's death. The vice president was shocked. He had not even known that Harrison was sick. 2 hours after he received the news, Tyler was on his way to Washington. There was some question about Tyler's official duties. Harrison's death marked the first time that a president had died in office. No one was sure what the Constitution meant when it said that the powers of a deceased president should go to the vice president. Eventually, Tyler, Webster, and other cabinet members decided that Tyler should be president and serve until the next election.
That was a very controversial claim because people said, no, he's not the president. He's an acting president. He's just temporarily filling the office, but he's not president.
Historian Michael Holt taught at the University of Virginia. He says, Although not everyone supported John Tyler's claim, he set an important example. He showed how power could transfer peacefully to the vice president after a U.S. president died in office. Tyler was sworn in as the nation's 10th president on April 6, 1841. He was 51 years old. No other man had become president at such an early age. Tyler was a slaveholding Southerner. He was born and grew up in the same part of Virginia as William Henry Harrison. His father was a wealthy landowner and judge who had been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Tyler completed studies at the College of William and Mary and became a lawyer. He entered politics and served in the Virginia State Legislature. Then he was elected a member of Congress and later governor of Virginia. He also served as a member of the United States Senate. Tyler believed strongly in the rights of the states. As a congressman and a senator, he had voted against every attempt to give more power to the federal government. In fact, historian Michael Holt says that in many ways, Tyler was more like a member of the Democrats, the opposing party at the time.
He favored the typical position of Democrats on what we could call domestic policy, which is that government is best which governs least. The less federal domestic policy you have trying to generate economic growth or improve society or whatever, the better.
In comparison, many Whig Party members firmly supported the ideas of a national bank, a protective tax on imports, and federal spending to improve transportation in the states. Tyler was just as firmly against these ideas. At the same time, many Democrats did not like the president either.
Most Democrats regarded him as a traitor who had jumped from the Jackson Party and joined the Whigs, however temporarily.
Michael Holt says even Tyler's appearance made him seem difficult and unpleasant.
You look at this guy and he's sort of aesthetically thin and with sunken cheeks and a long pointed nose. He just looks like he's unhappy with the world.
President Tyler quickly became even more unpopular over the issue of a new national bank. He wanted to establish such a bank in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The national bank could open offices in a state, but only if the state approved. Tyler's proposal was not the kind of bank most Whigs in Congress supported. They wanted no limits of any kind on the power of a national bank to open offices anywhere in the country. Whigs in Congress suggested a compromise. Bank offices would be permitted in any state where the state legislature did not immediately refuse permission. But President Tyler vetoed the compromise. He sent the bank bill back to Congress. The congressman wrote another bill. They said it was exactly what the president wanted. But the president did not agree. He said the states must have the right to approve or reject bank offices. He said this second bill would also be vetoed unless changes were made in it. The changes were not made, and Tyler did as he said he would do. He vetoed it. The decision created a crisis in the cabinet. All the president's advisors but one, Daniel Webster, resigned. Michael Holt says that several days later, most cabinet members and a large group of other Whig congressmen voted to expel Tyler from the party.
They read this paper saying he's no Whig. Don't blame us for all of his vetoes.
Harrison appointed a new cabinet of Whigs he hoped would be more friendly to him, but after a while, they too resigned. Michael Holt says Tyler made more changes in his cabinet than any other U.S. president. President Tyler struggled with his party over other issues. One was about import taxes. 2 years into Tyler's presidency, the government found itself short of money. It was spending more than it had. Congress decided that import taxes should be raised, some even higher than 20%. But President Tyler vetoed the bill. He said it was wrong to raise the tax so high and, at the same time, continue to give the states money from land sales. He said the federal government itself needed the land sale money. Michael Holt says once again the Whigs were angry. Their party controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, but they could not reach their goals.
The Whigs were elected with this agenda that they wanted Congress to pass, that they had promised would rescue the country from a very serious depression. And this included a new national bank, higher tariffs, distribution of federal revenues from public land sales.
President Tyler, he adds, frustrated the entire Whig legislative program. It was clear the Whigs would not nominate him for the next election, so Tyler turned his attention to the Democrats. He hoped they would ask him to be their presidential candidate in 1844. Tyler began appointing Democratic advisors to his cabinet, and he gave his support to one of the Democrats' causes, making Texas a state in the Union. Texas was an independent nation at the time. Some Americans wanted to bring Texas into the United States to further expand the country. But others were afraid that the territory would permit slavery. They wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler had the opposite fear. Michael Holt explains that Tyler was afraid that Texas would remain an independent republic and abolish slavery there.
He and other Southerners thought that that was a terrible idea, but he also believed that this is what's going to put him in the history books, that he's going to be responsible for adding this enormous Republic of Texas, although it wasn't quite as big as what they claimed, to the United States.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.